Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, they call themselves the Lord's Resistance Army, but have little to do with the God most of us know. We talked to one Sudanese bishop about how the vicious militant group is terrorizing the local population in southern Sudan. And the genie's out of the bottle, and the damage is done. But is it too late to save the planet's oceans and seas? They are some of the most vicious and heartless militants in the world, who have no qualms about massacring thousands of innocents. They are the footmen of Joseph Kony's guerrilla group, the Lord's Resistance Army, which, since 1987, has been waging a campaign to overthrow Uganda's government and establish a theocratic state based on the Ten Commandments and local Akoli tradition. But far from the God-given rules of the Ten Commandments most of us would know, Kony's foot soldiers have followed what seem to be rules of their own diabolical making. The LRA is responsible for tens of thousands of abductions of children and women forced into becoming soldiers themselves and sex slaves. Many are severely beaten, tortured, and disfigured. Many are forced to kill family members or friends. Nearly 2 million civilians have been forced to flee their homes, living in internally displaced person camps and on the streets.
There is a huge number of internally displaced people who have moved from those places. And then secondly, they have moved into the homes of the host community. Host families, they don't want to create camps for themselves. They come and enter into homes, and you find one household has a huge, huge number of people.
Bishop Edward Kusala of Tombura Yambio in southern Sudan says the LRA are now operating out of Sudan and nearby Democratic Republic of Congo, forcing hundreds out of their homes and villages. People in his own diocese are afraid.
Their presence in the towns, in fact, has caused big alarm. Concentration on the little resources we have, like schools, hospitals, water points. And on the basis of this, we have been making a lot of appeal on the side of the church for the people to collaborate, to work together. And not much has been realized. Anyway, from the side of the people, at least collaborations are there.
Bishop Kusala told Lydia O'Kane about the recent troubles that his diocese has been facing. Southern Sudan had enjoyed a fragile peace with the Khartoum government, he acknowledges, but now the LRA has turned any hopes for peace upside down.
When they come to areas, the way they behave is terrible. They abduct the young people, they kill those who are resistant or the old elder people, and they kidnap with them so many, and you never see them again. And when even they kill, it's not a proper killing. It's inhuman. They cut people into pieces. They do all kinds of evil on the bodies of people they kill. With this, it has continued all over the area. And now even because the whole movement of the LRA is at the border between Congo and Sudan, the people in Congo have run over to Sudan. We have over 25,000 refugees from Congo in a place, in one of my parishes called Izo. And then we have another one in Yambio, which is Mopondo, which has 17,000 people. And there are many others that who are not in the camps that live within the villages and the towns in the area, in the Sudan. What are the responses We make advocacy on behalf of this. And many church organizations have tried to pay attention to us, and they still try to assess, you know, the bureaucracy within the international NGOs. But I'm very thankful to CAFOD and Caritas Germany, Caritas Internationalis, Aid to the Church in Need, and the CRS. This group have been able to come to our aid, but we are still working on the modality because the number of people is so huge to see how best we can be able to support them. So the resources we have is very meager. Right now for schools, the children have to stay under the trees in order to learn. And when the rain comes, you know, our area is a rainy season, all is bad. Another major problem, fear I have, is there is going to be famine in the whole state next year or soon this year. Because the area is agricultural, people in that area live by growing their own food stuff. But now with the conflict, nobody's able to go to the forest, to the fields to cultivate. So they all keep themselves within the towns. So you can imagine that there's going to be huge number of people looking for food aid. And we don't have yet the possibility to have this food available for the people. The second worrying factor is with the presence of the LRA in the area, there is not any single visible sign or program or plan to get rid of coney from that forest. Right from my government of the National Unity, government of Southern Sudan, and the international community, there is no sign, no program. Yes, you see soldiers moving around, but you just wonder, a handful of men in the forest can defeat the whole Sudanese army, can defeat the whole, now we have the Ugandan army that have come in, can defeat these people, and they can defeat the international community, and they tell me that, no, this man is a rebel, is a gorilla. Gorillas can be arrested. If there's a goodwill, there's a real interest, I'm sure Kony can be stopped and from doing what he's doing. This is where the third worrying point is, as this problem continues to grow, there are a lot of dissatisfaction among the people of the area. People are very sad. People are frustrated. They live in fear. And they ask many answerable questions, which they don't find answers to them. And to me, as I read it between the lines, It's a boiling point within the hearts of the people. It can explode into something very bad. It's going to cause tribal conflict. It's going to cause a genocide. It's going to cause any kind of unrest in the area. So I have this as a worrying point, and we have so much important programs to come in the future. To me, it's deplorable. It's terrible, and it needs an attention. Here I also remain in a dilemma when I have to think of the international community. I know that, of course, the what always happens is the international community come in when people have already died and there's already life lost, and then people come in and ask questions. Maybe that's what they're waiting for, you know, in Equatorial. So this is the situation we go through at this moment.
The international community has come so far, but they don't seem to have gone far enough on this issue. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And actually, this is the nightmare for most of us in Sudan. We know that the international community worked very hard to get the peace that we have now. They spend a lot of resources, human and material and financial resources, in order to get this peace signed. With the signing of the peace agreement, we have a feeling that they have just given up and have left the situation as it is, but there's not yet peace. And I believe the whole of South Sudan, all the states in South Sudan are unstable. They are not in peaceful situation. It's not only the situation in Western Equatoria. Ours is the presence of the Ugandan rebels in the area, but in the neighboring states have tribal conflicts. They have militias. They have certain banditry group. So these are indications that there might have been some working groups behind these things, behind the scene. We are wondering, because you get this, some ethnic groups, some militias with a lot of weapons, a lot of ammunition. Where do they get these things from? And as it goes on with all these confusions, we don't see any clear stand in a way like putting our government on the ground and say, look, what's going on? And both the government and the North, you never hear any comment about this. It's not that the affair for South Sudan. But we are also, in a way, working towards maybe the United Sudan. How do we live? If they talk making peace, unity and attractive, it means every Sudanese is supposed to pay attention to the welfare of everybody so that we feel as a people of one nation. This, again, to me, I feel that there's not much being done from the side of the international community. Here we have many major European countries that were involved in the signing of the agreement, the European Union, the American government, the IGAD, all these people. You seem to see a lot of bureaucrats, a lot of offices, a lot of structures have been created. And what I'm talking about, if you look at the structure in Sudan, you will find a lot of commissions, committees set up for monitoring the peace implementation. But what's happening? We don't hear any condemnation of these things and no serious engagement of the people in charge. So people let things to go as they are. Of course, as believers, we keep on hoping and we hope things will change, but we need to see it concretely being realized that people follow up the peace implementation, and also knowing the consequences of the 2012 referendum, which is going to take place in Sudan. The end could be terrible. So people need to be prepared, and this is the humble time that both the American government, the European Union, need again to revise their collaborative effort to see that peace is built in Sudan. So we are on the hope, and we keep on talking about this and calling on these recognized bodies to see that the conflict in the country be stopped forever.
And a warm thanks there to Bishop Edward Kusala of the Southern Sudanese Diocese of Tombura, Yambio. There's so much of them that we mostly take them for granted. But a growing number of people say we can't afford to do that anymore. The world's oceans and seas are in danger, and the danger is thanks to us.
We're now looking at widespread contamination throughout the marine environment. Even in the most remote areas of the Arctic and Antarctic, you can find some of these industrial chemicals turning up in the sediments, in the water, and in the fish and other species that live there.
We've really got to take stock of what we're doing in our world, in our oceans, especially for our future generations, because this is a beautiful world and we're ruining it. We're just vandals.
Our seas and oceans absorb tons of pollutants every year, and if we fail to turn the tide, our failures will come back to haunt us. One environmentalist website I saw recently had a phrase that really struck me. Sea dumping exists as a result of the misconception that the ocean is big enough to be unaffected by anything that we could do. How big a misconception is it? Well, I asked Dr. David Santillo, a marine biologist and chemist who works as a senior scientist at Greenpeace Research Laboratories at the UK's University of Exeter.
It is a very big misconception, and it's something which really underpins people's approaches to waste disposal using the oceans in previous decades. The idea that it was out of sight, out of mind, that the oceans had a huge capacity to assimilate our waste really drove the development of early controls on environmental pollution. And for many chemicals, which simply don't disappear, they're not assimilated, they build back up again through the food chain. It's simply not an approach to pollution management that has any basis in environmental protection.
What is the kind of waste that, unfortunately, we're finding in our seas and oceans and even in rivers today?
The types of wastes that are currently polluting our rivers and our oceans is a huge variety of different chemicals. Some of the most problematic ones are things like heavy metals, lead and cadmium and mercury, but also some very persistent organic chemicals, things like pesticides, industrial chemicals, that really aren't broken down when they're released to the environment. And as a result, they can travel over very large distances. Once they're discharged or dumped in the sea, they can get into marine life and build up in the body tissues of those organisms and into fish. And ultimately, we end up getting the pollution back because what we're doing, in effect, is contaminating the marine food chain. And that's a food chain, obviously, that we rely upon right around the world.
What are the primary sources, then, of the pollutants that we're finding in the seas and oceans?
There are many, many different sources of marine pollution. Those can be direct discharges of waste from industries located around the coast. They can also be a result of those same chemicals being discharged into river systems. You know, water has been seen for many, many generations as a very convenient way of getting rid of our waste. And although it takes the waste away from the immediate area of discharge, we end up with problems occurring in the sea. But it's not just about point sources of pollution. There are a lot of what are called diffuse sources that can include runoff from agricultural fields, runoff from urban areas in cities, sewage pollution, all kinds of sources of contamination. Because we've been very poor over the years in managing those wastes, and it's been too convenient to see the sea as a great place to dump all the things that we don't want. And I think it's only really been in the last 15 or 20 years that we've come to a realization of what the consequences of that mismanagement of chemicals has been, that we're now looking at widespread contamination throughout the marine environment. Even in the most remote areas of the Arctic and Antarctic, you can find some of these industrial chemicals turning up in the sediments, in the water, and in the fish and other species that live there.
I was reading that actually one of the main components of plastic has been found to affect estrogen levels in humans and animals and, of course, in fish. How is that affecting the fish population?
It's very difficult to say how any particular chemical is impacting on fish populations in the marine environment. I think the difficulty here is that just as it is very complex to describe marine pollution to a full extent because of the huge variety of chemicals that are involved, you know, the differences from one location to another, it becomes even more difficult when you then start to look at what the effects of that will be on any particular species or on marine ecosystems overall. Assessments tend to focus on one chemical at a time, and there have been reassurances given in the past that certain chemicals are present, but present at levels that are unlikely to affect certain species. The difficulty, of course, is that no species is exposed to one chemical at a time. There's always that cocktail effect, that cocktail of chemicals out into the environment. Predicting the effects of those can be very difficult. But you're right, there are concerns over some of the polluting chemicals being able to interfere on a very fundamental level with hormone communication, with reproductive development, with resistance to disease in all types of marine animals, and that is a huge concern.
70% of the world's surface is covered by ocean. That's a huge area.
Australia's Ted Richardson is regional coordinator for Oceania for the Church's Apostleship of the Sea. He's concerned that sea dumping and chemical runoff are a recipe for disaster, and not just for marine life.
We do a great deal of harm. So that mindset of the people think, oh, it's just in that spot. It doesn't stay in that spot. It travels everywhere. It travels through the whole food chain. And eventually we pick it up and we get the remnants of the dumping of the rubbish. You know, we recycle that rubbish through our bodies. And it's just not a good environment to be doing that sort of thing in. We should not use the sea as their own dumping ground in their backyards.
Now, I think everybody has pretty clear in their minds those images that we've all seen on television when there's a huge oil spill of birds and fish covered in that slick black oil. However, there are a lot of invisible things that have been dumped into our oceans that we don't see. I'm thinking of the chemicals, even nuclear waste.
Yes, it's an incredible amount. Even it's the Second World War dumping, I think the website I looked at had something like 200,000 tons of chemical weapons dumped at sea. That's mustard gas and all these blistering agents just dumped in barrels. In some cases, they had so much of it, they put it inside Liberty ships and just sunk the ships. In one case, the Americans, just off the coast of Florida, decided, you know, the drums didn't sink, so they got guns out and they shot holes in the drums so they'd sink. What happened to the chemicals? Where did they go? You put a hole in the drum, the chemical's going to leach out. Yeah, all these things are rusting, corroding away. There's something like 97 nuclear weapons sitting at the bottom of the sea, just corroding and rotting away. There's 9 nuclear reactors sitting at the bottom of the sea, rotting away, waiting to leak out. This is an environmental catastrophe just waiting to happen. And we're not doing anything about it. We're not doing anything about cleaning it up and going back to that environment and saying, OK, let's tidy it up and get rid of this stuff. We're just leaving it there. And eventually we're going to pay the price of that, that destruction.
To your knowledge, where are many of these dumping grounds?
All over the world, around the UK, the Channel Islands, through Russia, in the Baltic Sea, off the coast of America, the Pacific Island, Pacific region, just about anywhere where they can find a nice deep hole, that's where it all goes. And they think if it's just deep enough, it's far enough away that we can't be affected by it. And in truth, we're going to be very much affected by it. That stuff will just travel anywhere. As long as water and currents move, we will get it.
There is evidence that some of those containers of munitions, of chemical weapons, are beginning to leak. There have been cases where chemical weapons have even been washed up on beaches or fished up in nets by trawlers. So this is a long-term legacy. And I think that all we can do is try our best to document where these things are, where possible to recover, to retrieve those and make them safe. But also, more broadly, to learn the lesson of just what happens when we use the marine environment as a dumping ground. And this, what we're doing now, could have consequences for generations to come, just as those deliberately dumped weapons and munitions are having for us now. We need to have better and better information on the extent of marine pollution. And that's true whether we're talking about wastes that have been deliberately dumped or whether we're talking about ongoing sources of pollution. We need to have a much clearer understanding as to what the effects and the consequences are on marine environment and also on our own use of marine resources. But at the same time, documenting pollution won't resolve the problem. And what we need is a far greater focus on dealing with pollution problems as far upstream as possible. We can no longer rely on the seas to take away our pollution and to in some way assimilate it or deal with it so that it can be out of sight, out of mind. Unless we look at the production processes themselves, unless we look at the sources of that pollution and try to address those as far as possible, we're not going to solve the problem of marine pollution, and it's going to be there for our children and our grandchildren to deal with in the future. And really, we cannot miss this responsibility.
Yeah, one thing we haven't talked really about is cleaning up all of the mess.
The problem with marine pollution is that it becomes very difficult to try and remediate the problem once you've caused it. So once chemicals are released in the marine environment, the genie is really out of the box. And although there are such situations where it is possible to clean up very restricted areas that perhaps have been impacted by an oil spill or a particular chemical spill, cleaning up marine pollution more generally simply isn't an option. So the only real way, the only sustainable way of dealing with marine pollution is to deal with the problem at source by stopping that pollution going in the first place. And that needs better regulation on dumping of waste from ships, a better regulation of discharge of waste from onshore facilities, better regulation of the oil and gas industry, which is also a significant source of marine pollution in some areas. And until we get that right, we're simply going to be adding to the problem that's already there.
We already suffer from overfishing in the world's fleets. We're fishing more out of the sea than ever before. So the numbers of fish are declining. And then now that they're getting all these chemicals as well into the fish chain and the food chain, I don't think the future, the way we're going, is going to be very bright for a seafood industry or for ourselves. We've really got to take stock of what we're doing in our world, in our oceans especially, for our future generations, because this is a beautiful world and we're ruining it. Governments really have to step back and say, why are we carrying this stuff to the sea? Why are we sending all these nuclear weapons all over the place on ships? Are we that afraid now that there's going to be a nuclear attack on somebody that we have to have all these nuclear bombs and weapons on submarines that sink and are left to corrode and rot away at the bottom of the ocean, and 2, 3, 4 generations from now we'll start to feel the effects of them? I think we owe to our future generations not to let that happen.
We as individuals may not be able to do much about preventing chemicals from entering the marine environment, but we certainly can do more to keep our waters clean. What does the church say is the individual's responsibility to protect the environment?
Well, the church says that we are stewards of our environment, and to be a good steward means that we do look after it, we do care about it. It's the people who just throw their rubbish, not so much directly into the sea, but they'll throw it into creeks, and into things that feed into the sea. And it gets washed down. We get the heavy rains and it just floods out and down it goes. There are plastics and plastic bottles and things that fish get stuck in. And as you say, toilet seats and toilet bowls and old boots and anything that gets chucked down into what they call maybe their own farm landfill site, it'll get washed away and eventually it'll work its way into the sea. And then, lovely people go around and clean up those beaches, and they shouldn't have to do that. Because if we all stop and think about where we're putting our garbage, what we're doing with our garbage, how are we recycling that garbage? Are we recycling it, in fact? Or are we just letting the environment deal with it? And the environment only has one way. It's everything goes into the sea. And, again, we end up having these messy, horrible beaches. And if people didn't clean them up, imagine what they would look like in a few years' time. Nobody would want to go there. Nobody would want to even try and walk along the beach because they'd be stepping over all everybody else's rubbish. Even our landfill sites and garbage tips, we need to recycle as much as we possibly can. There's a lot there that can be recycled. A lot of green waste and a lot of plastics can be recycled. We're still not getting the message about recycling all of those things. We're just throwing them away. We've got a motto in Australia, and it just says, don't destroy what you come to enjoy. And if you enjoy the seaside, if you enjoy the beach and the sea, don't destroy it. Look after it. Think about what you're doing before you do it. Say, if I throw this away here, where is it going to go? Where's the cigarette butt that I throw in the street going to finish up? It's the toxic chemicals in the cigarette butt that gets washed out the drains and out into the sea. We have to take a better view on what we're doing with the environment, or as I say, we're going to pay the price. Well, our next generation will, our children will.
Ted Richardson is regional coordinator for the Church's Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania. And earlier you heard Dr. David Santillo, senior scientist and biologist at Greenpeace Laboratories at the University of Exeter. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for listening.
Laudator Jesus Christus.